We will call the regular finance committee meeting to order Tuesday, October 5th, 10 o'clock. Item one on the agenda, which is blocked by some little window here, which I can't see. Hold on. There we go. Comments from the public. Is there
no hands raised, no chats?
Okay. Finance monthly updates, recruitment, that's either Tom or Paula.
I'll take all of these, actually. So just really quick regarding the recruitment, I'll skip around on the report, but we recently onboarded a retired annuitant. Her name is Cindy Sun. She's here to assist us with some of the accounting challenges that we've encountered over the last few months. She and Minaj have been working to clean up 2021 fiscal year, get all of the financials ready for our upcoming audit. We are a little late starting our audit, but there are some things that we need to clean up. One of the things that we need to clean up are the 1920 year and fund balance closures for all of our retained revenues. So that's part of the process that they are working on to get all of that cleaned up and then get the 1920 fiscal year closed out and the starting beginning balances for all of our retained revenue and reserve accounts correct, so we can report them accurately for the 2021 audit. We're also cleaning up some of the entries that were done last year, just to kind of give directors and staff an idea of what we're dealing with. Some of the entries, the journal entries that we're doing, have been extremely complicated. And unraveling them, we've found that there are a lot of unnecessary entries that had been done in the past. And so what we're doing as we move forward is cleaning these entries up and correcting the process moving forward. So I think that's why our reporting hasn't been timely and we're having some challenges in getting all of our financials up to speed. A lot of cleanup has to happen in order for us to do this the right way moving forward, especially with us looking at doing an ERP. Further recruitment, we still have the accounting manager position open and the accountant position open. We do have another meeting scheduled tomorrow for a potential candidate for the accounting manager. And we are looking to fill the accountant position with more information to come on that. And we have a part-time person. His name is Sean Rose. He started last week, Monday, and he is assisting us with our utility billing. One of the plans that we have is to have someone that is going to take on the role of customer service utility billing and be the focal person that's going to assist with all of things utility billing and customer service and all of the processes associated with that. And so we'll get these streamlined. We're going to have Yolanda come out the week of October 25th to train for the entire week. We'll have several staff in training, so we'll get a full understanding of how the system works. We want to bring the utility billing process back in-house, and we want to be able to do it correctly. We're also looking for a part-time HR payroll specialist that can assist in the day-to-day operations. We need someone that will come in and help us with maintaining personnel records, workers' compensation, claims reporting, OSHA reporting, risk management, safety, training, all kinds of fun stuff. There's a significant need for this type of experience. And then speaking to the ERP, we have a demonstration with Tyler Technologies tomorrow. The district will be closed tomorrow so that all staff can participate in this demonstration. We will be walking through the system's functionality and step-by-step processes on how to do financials, HR, payroll, and utility billing. And we'll be doing this throughout the entire day. And so I just want to thank the board for allowing us to take the time to thoroughly review the system and give us the ability to do that without interruptions. Any questions?
Only Paula, do you like in terms of being ready for the audit, what's the timeline on that? What's the cutoff? When do you have to be ready to do that?
I guess we should have already been ready. I think once we get all of the final journal entries completed, it should go fairly quickly. You know, we're obviously a small agency, so it won't take that long for our auditors to go through. Really, it's just a matter of cleaning up all of our journal entries to make sure that we're giving the auditors good data so that they can pull the schedules and look at the numbers and get an accurate representation of our financials. So typically audits are completed by December 1st. I don't feel that we will miss that deadline. I think that if we do, it will really just be because we have certain things that we are unable to reconcile. And I'm hoping that with all of this cleanup that Minaj and Cindy and I are working on, that we're going to meet that deadline.
Okay. So you good, Paula? Are we done?
Yes, I'm done.
So we move on. Okay. Item four, discuss sample security survey opinion poll questions.
So I'll introduce this one. On the call this afternoon or this morning is Timothy McLarney. He's the polling expert we hired from True North Research to conduct the security opinion poll. And as promised, we're right on schedule. As promised, we've asked Timothy to kind of go through his proposed questions on how we're going to handle the study and answer questions from this committee. And then this committee can then determine the next step. And the next step could be we go back to the drawing board and rework the questions, or it could be make a few tweaks to the questions and do the same presentation for the board later on this month. Or it could also be, you know, change half of them and bring this back to the committee in November, back to the finance committee in November. So this is kind of a major check-in point for the finance committee directors to get a sense on where we're at and how prepared we are to cut Timothy loose with his work that's going to be done by True North, and eventually we'll come back to the board either in December or January with the story, the recommendation, and the results. So I've asked Timothy to get on the line and kind of walk through, and this is the opportunity for the committee members on the finance committee to ask questions in public and to have a public discussion. So that being said, any questions, or we can just let Timothy get going.
Why don't we let Timothy get us started here, and then we'll
great
the questions.
Well, good morning to everyone. I wanted to sort of open this up. What my plan for today was to walk through this survey instrument and sort of explain the rhyme and the reason for why we ask the questions that we ask. And you know, I'm not going to read line by line, but as I go, I would welcome questions from the committee members as I go, or at the end, whichever is your preference. We can certainly make this a little more of a discussion. One thing I'm going to say at the outset is, you know, we've worked on over 400 surveys for public agencies where the goal was to understand if it's feasible to move forward with some type of revenue measure. And if it is feasible, to determine how you would go about structuring that measure in a way that it's consistent with the type of measure that your voters are interested in supporting, right? And the basic layout and structure of a revenue measure feasibility survey is sort of tried and true, right? So whether we're doing a survey for a community services district about a potential security measure, as is the case here, or a city about a potential sales tax measure, or a school about a potential bond measure, the basic pieces of information you need to understand to determine if it's feasible to move forward with a measure, meaning it has a reasonable chance of success, are kind of the same. So the specifics all change, but there is a sort of logic to the flow and layout of the questions. And I just wanted to say that at the outset, because as I go through, you'll see that you know, we're sort of building this pile of information up that collectively at the end will give us a lot of information about should you move forward, and if so, how. So A couple things I just point out at the top. We'll just start right at the top. You'll see at the introduction here, we say, you know, this is a survey of voters about important issues in the community. I'd like to get your opinions. We purposely don't say too much in the introduction about exactly what the survey is going to be about, meaning we don't say it's about security or we don't say that it's about taxes. The reason for that is because the more you tip your hand at the point that you're soliciting someone's participation in a survey about what that survey is about, the more you have the potential to create what's called a selection bias or a self-selection bias. The people who are really interested or passionate about security or interested and passionate about taxes are more likely to jump in and take the survey than, say, the average voter who may have more moderate level of interest. And so we try and avoid that selection bias by, you know, telling them it's about important issues in the community, but not being overly specific about exactly what the survey is about, right? So that's the introduction there. As you move down, we have what I would call are a few warm-up questions, just to kind of get the respondent thinking about their community and thinking about local issues. The first was simply how long they've lived in the community. We will know based on their voter registration status how long they've been registered to vote in Rancho Murrieta, but we won't necessarily know how long they've lived here, right? So you could have somebody who, say, grew up here and then came of age and, you know, started to, you know, register to vote 2 years ago. That's different than somebody who moved into the community 2 years ago, right? And so we asked this question. It's also as a double check on item 7 there. You can see where they say, I don't live in Rancho Murrieta. The voter file isn't perfectly up to date, right? There's always some lag time in terms of, you know, if somebody up and moved out of Rancho Murrieta in the last couple months, that won't register on the voter file. And so we want to give somebody the option to say they no longer live in Rancho Murrieta, because those are individuals that then won't be voting here and really shouldn't be part of the sample. If you go on to question number 2 here, we just simply ask folks to tell us how they'd rate the overall quality of life in the community. Would they say it's excellent, good, fair, poor, or very poor? This is also, I think, potentially interesting in terms of when you look at the answers to this question in relation to how someone may view a potential security measure. Perhaps there are some individuals who are a little lower on the scale, and it's linked to the idea that, hey, you know, we're not as safe as we should be, perhaps, right? And so there's a nexus there that we can look at. And then question number three, if you move down, following up that overarching question about rating the quality of life, we asked them if they could change one thing to make Rancho Murrieta a better place to live, what change would they like to see? That gray box there signifies it's an open-ended question. And what that means is they get to tell us in their own words what one thing comes to mind. So we're not prompting them with a specific list of issues. So this is a really good measure of saliency. Like, what's the top of mind thing that pops into their head? And naturally, we're going to be looking for, you know, to what extent do, you know, issues of security and safety pop up in response to question 3 versus, you know, other issues like water or like, more special events, who knows, right?
Hey, Tim.
Yep.
This is Tom. Does that mean you're recording that part of the answer?
We aren't recording it. In California, you are not allowed to record unless you tell people you're recording, right? But someone can tell us something and we type it in, or when it's an online survey, they can type it in themselves. And what happens is we go back and look at all those verbatim responses, and then we will group them into categories based on commonalities, right? So we'll be able, you won't just have a laundry list of open-ended statements. We'll group them and show, you know, hey, security comes in as number 3 with this many people hitting on it, right? We'll be able to share that level of information.
Okay.
The one other thing that I like about question 3 is occasionally you get a respondent who's got a burning issue, right? They've got something that they really want to get off their chest. Question 3 gives them that opportunity to do that. And then they're more likely to sort of pay attention to the root questions that we're asking and give meaningful answers to those questions. if you don't give them an opportunity to get their issue off their chest, they're constantly looking for that opportunity, and it can act, and they start trying to plug in the answer that they want to give you to a different question to the one you're asking here. And so it's just good to let, you know, three sort of gives them that opportunity. And then from there, they settle in and, you know, are a little more focused on the question that we're actually asking them. And then finally, four, whereas question three is open-ended, so what's top of mind for them? Question four, we go through each of the specific items shown there, if you can pan up a little bit. And we're going to ask them to tell us how important that issue is to them on a scale of extremely important, very important, somewhat important, not at all important. And here, it allows us to do a few things. Number one, clearly it allows us to understand how issues related to safety and security and nexus with the measure you're considering. So item C, for example, preventing trespassing in the community. Item G, maintaining a low crime rate, right? H, preparing for emergencies, natural disasters, et cetera. How those items, and D, improving public safety, how those items stack up against other issues that are obviously important benchmarks, things like maintaining local streets and roads, for example, in item A, how those things stack up against each other. And also, how do those items stack up in particular against item E, which is preventing local tax increases. It is a rough rule of thumb, but it's surprisingly consistent. The more importance a voter is going to place on issues that will be addressed by your measure, right, security and safety related issues, relative to the issue of preventing local tax increases, the more likely that voter is to be a voter in support of your proposal, right? The more the community views preventing local tax increases as more important than these issues, the steeper the hill is to climb to be able to have a successful measure. So it's really kind of this question gives us sort of this very 30,000 foot view of what your voters care about and the relative importance of these issues. And that often will tell, you know, even if we don't know the answers to the rest of the questions in the survey, sometimes I can look at the answers to that and kind of know where this is going to go. So, and it's not meant to be an exhaustive list either, right? We're not trying to hit every issue. We're just trying to, you know, get some high level reads. So if you'd move on down, after these, what I would call sort of warm-up questions, we get right to it with the initial ballot test. And the idea here is before we get any deeper into the interview and we start talking in more detail about sort of the security needs of the community and how the money could be spent in more specificity, arguments pro and con, tax rates, et cetera, we want to present to the respondent a mock-up of what we think that 75-word ballot statement could look like if the board were to choose to place it on a ballot and get their reaction. It is a really good gauge of where the community is at on the natural with respect to this proposal, recognizing they haven't heard much about it to this point, right? Either in the survey or in larger discussions in the community. So it's a really good sort of gauge of where are we today with just the level of information or lack thereof in the community about this proposal. When we do these surveys, it is important that the proposal, the question five here, the initial ballot test, be consistent with the type of language that you could actually place on the ballot if you move forward. It doesn't do us any good to test a concept like, oh, would you pay an extra amount of this to have better security? If that, at the end of the day, that's not the question that's going to get asked, right? They're going to vote on a legally compliant 75-word ballot statement. And so that's what we're putting in front of them, something that we think is legally compliant, checks all the boxes, but also, you know, does our best job of making sure it describes this thing accurately. A couple of thoughts on this real quick. It is now the case, it certainly wasn't the case with Measure J, and it even wasn't the case 5 years ago, but it is now the case that if you're going to do these tax measures, there are certain pieces of information that we have to convey in the 75 words. One is the tax rate, which in this case is that 298 in the initial test. One is the amount of money raised annually. That is the providing $800,000 annually estimate. And the other is the duration right? Which annually until ended by voters. You see that annually until ended by voters? That is the duration. And so you need the annual, the amount of the tax, the amount it's going to raise annually, and the duration to be in the 75-word balance statement, which we have here. The wording's a little wonky in that second paragraph, but that again is, you know, us trying to be legally compliant. The shall the Rancho Murrieta Community Service District measure be approved? That language is required as part of this. And then, but if you look above it, you can see in the bullets, this is where we kind of have some space to talk about what this measure will accomplish, right? And it has to be neutral, right? We can't talk about it in a persuasive way in that way. But so we have the three bullets there about preventing crime and better protecting the lives and property of Rancho Murrieta residents and businesses, providing additional patrols by sheriff's deputies and security staff, and continuing gate security 24 hours per day, seven per day year round. That's about as much space as we have to describe what it's going to do, at which point we have to get into all the legal requirements in the second paragraph. So let me stop there and see if there's any questions, comments, concerns.
Marty, anything?
We're not muted.
Marty, any questions?
Yeah, I had a question about what we're suggesting in the second bullet about providing additional sheriff's deputies. Have we have some sort of idea what we're proposing?
I think, Martin, the proposal is to become more formal with the use of sheriff's deputies on a per hour basis at critical times. And so our experience this past summer was pretty good in that we were providing anywhere between 12 and 24 hours of additional sheriff's patrols on Friday and Saturday during the most important times. And I think that had a pretty good impact on what happened here this summer as compared to last. And I think what we're proposing is a specific number of hours each month, some months having more than others possibly. And that's what we're proposing. Just more of a set number of hours each month or each week.
So how much are we proposing to increase it?
Well, I would propose that, you know, and we haven't gotten into the weeds that deeply on a schedule, but I do believe almost every weekend there needs to be sheriff's patrol operations out here to handle the influx and activity that happens on the weekend nights.
Okay, are we gonna have that figured out before we do the question, we do the survey?
Yes.
Second question, can you provide some sort of a derivation of this $298? And then third question is, are we able to have a different rate for different parts of the community?
Well, the part about this that is probably more is different than Measure J is the majority of the increase is for patrol services. And to this point in time, we haven't talked about there being just patrol behind the gates or just patrol on the other side of the highway. This is just added patrol district wide. And as far as I know from, are you familiar with the Baracus decision, Timothy?
I don't know the specifics, so go ahead.
It's a recent legal decision that was made down in Southern California that when you apply a tax like this, and I'm not the attorney, I just had plenty of conversations with our attorney about this, but when you apply this sort of new fee to properties, that all properties end up having to pay the same amount. And how we have our Measure J set up, and it's pre-Baracus decision, is different types of properties pay security fees at a different rate. And so far we're with this poll, we're not talking so much about support for the gates, although it's slightly discussed, but this is all about adding and paying for patrol services. So it could be when all is said and done that the rate people pay is the same across the street as it is behind the gates.
Well, I know that, you know, that there's a difference between what part of the code we're using in terms of parcel taxes. So, for example, on education parcel taxes for schools, it's a different part of the code. And there, the determination was made that you can't vary the rate based on parcel types, right? That you could do a square footage rate, right? If you wanted to base it on square footage, the rate's the same. It's the square footage that varies, right? But you can't come in and say, you know, property owners, you know, that in this part of the district are going to pay $100, and in that, and commercial property is going to pay $2,000, for example. There's limits. I do know, though, that when working with other special districts, and we've worked with fire districts before, where, you know, the amount that is charged to properties will vary based on geographic location and property type and or size. And that has, you know, up until even recently been perfectly fine. That said, you know, I would, you know, whatever we sort of, you know, before we field this survey, we are going to want to confirm this with your legal counsel that yes, the rate structure and amounts and everything are consistent with what's being required legally, right? And so, you know, whatever we, before we go out and finalize this, I mean, if we get comfortable what's here, I'm confident that this is legally compliant, but every attorney has their own sort of view on things. And so we would want to make sure that yours is comfortable too.
One of the things, Marty, too, that I just want to make sure I understand where we're going here. If this were to pass, this being what we're describing, as I understand it, there is no change essentially in the commercial rate or the country club rate, unless we were to go back and do a wholesale realignment of Measure J. I don't think anything really changes here, other than the fact that we collect more based on the current formulas, and then we apply that to paying for patrol. That's my
understanding, but
yes,
I was under the understanding that this $298 would be for everybody would get the same rate, but we'll find that out, I guess.
Yeah, right now, the way it is, I will say this, that would certainly simplify things in terms of the language here, because you can see here that we have this Measure B approved levying $298 annually per residential property behind the gates, and then parentheses with other rates applying to multifamily, commercial, and outside the gates. If we're going to be varying rates, there has to be something, some language like that in the 75 words to at least alert the voter to that fact. If it's one rate per parcel flat, then it's simpler. And then sometimes I've seen where it's flat per residential property, but then it's something different for commercial, right? But we just have to make sure that whatever ultimately the rate structure looks like, that the ballot language lines up with that.
Makes sense.
So, and right now, though, as it sits, as you can see here from the language, this sort of presumes different costs depending on whether a property is inside the gate versus outside the gate, is residential, commercial, and that there's also some allowance made for multifamily versus single family. So right now it is sort of presuming different amounts depending on where and what type of property. That can be changed, but the language here is built that way, and you'll see that there's another section we're going to get to here in a second where it kind of continues with that concept.
I do have a public comment. Would you like to take that now, Tim, or would you like to wait until the end?
Sure.
Richard Gears.
Yeah, I read this question. Important information that's missing for me is this $298 in addition to the current Measure J amount, or is this going to be the total amount that we're going to have to pay? I mean, I can't answer this question unless I know that.
So this, the way this measure would be is constructed is it does not touch Measure J, right? Measure J is already in place and approved. So anything that this measure does, it's not going back and cracking into Measure J and changing Measure J. This is a separate measure. So the 298 would be on top of Measure J. It would not be a replacement of or a modification of Measure J.
And do you think this ought to mention that this is an addition to the current amount?
It's a separate measure. So no, the way legally we do this, it's its own measure. People vote on it, stand up as it is. Referencing, once you start cracking into Measure J, in the 75 words you have here, you would run out of room. Keeping in mind that a lot of people don't even know what Measure J is, right? And so the way when you are layering a new measure, it's about this measure. Now, in terms of communications outside of the 75 words to the community, certainly there's opportunities there to clarify, right? But within the 75 words, we're pretty constricted on what we can say and what we have to say.
I'd be concerned that you might get misleading answers. You know, you might do your survey and then people might find out, well, this $298 is in addition to our current amount, and they might decide to vote differently than they said on the survey.
Well, you'll see, I think in the next section, we get more into the specifics of the dollars. And here we are talking about additional money. We clarify that a bit without bringing up Measure J, but we do clarify that this is additional dollars, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So if there's no other questions on that, you're going to see that language in again a couple times in the survey. And that's why I wanted to stop and pause on it, because it's really important language. So question six then follows up. Anybody who says in response to that initial ballot test, no or not sure, we simply ask them if there's a particular reason for this. Again, this is an open-ended question. They can tell us in their own words. I call this kind of the canary in the coal mine question, right? It's important for us to know if people are opposed, why they're opposed now, and are we seeing the usual reasons why people say no to a revenue measure? You know, taxes are already too high, I don't trust government, that kind of stuff, right? Versus something else that we wouldn't have anticipated. And better that we know that now, right, than move forward, put something on the ballot and get surprised later, right? And so question six is an opportunity for those who aren't sure or are no on this measure to articulate why. Keep on moving down, if you would. So then we get into the tax threshold section. And here is where we are going to kind of put the blinders on the voter and focus their attention on the dollars, right? That 75-word ballot statement is kind of a package deal of here's all the things you get, right? The service improvements, and here's the price tag. Here, we're just going to focus their attention on the price tag to make sure they're A, very clear again that this is additional money, and B, that we want to give them a sense of the range of dollars that could be associated with this tax. The ballot language starts out at 298, and so we always sort of start high and go low. That's called a Dutch auction. That is the best way to figure out at what dollar amount somebody's willing to jump in and say yes. If you start low and go high, it doesn't work. Right. If I offer you something for $10, you say yes, and then I offer it to you for $20, you're not going to say yes to $20, right? Because you already know you got it offered at 10. So if you start high and go low, it works a lot better. So you see in question seven, and this is for properties that are behind the gates, right? We mentioned that this is annual property taxes paid by residents of commercial properties. However, the amount to be charged to each parcel hasn't been determined yet, and will depend on whether the property is inside or outside the gate. So again, we're continuing right now with that rate structure with the understanding it's going to vary depending on location and type of property. And then we said, if they knew that your house would pay an additional $298 per year, would you vote yes or no? If they're a definitely yes at 298, We don't have to ask about 248 or 198. We can assume they're yes there too, and they move on. If they're anything other than a definite yes at 298, then we ask 248, and the same rule apply for if we then go on to ask 198. So here we're just varying the price tag to get an understanding of, you know, at each one of these levels, you know, is there a point at which a voter jumps in and says yes?
So Timothy, I want to jump in here for a quick second, just so Martin and John can hear the comment. There's been a number of studies over the past 10 or 15 years talking about, are you willing to pay this much more or this much more for added security? And it was always, are you willing to pay 5% more or 10% more or 15% more? And right around 10%, everybody kind of dropped off as a no. And this is not, this question's way different. Everybody behind the gate right now is paying about just under $400 a year. This is about a 60, 70, 80% increase question in order to get a much, you know, a second level of patrol services district wide. So the reality is if people really want to have that much more security, it's going to cost a significant amount of money rather than just 5 or 10% more than they're paying today. So it's not, it's $20, $25 a month versus $6 or $7 a month more. And I just wanted to differentiate this process we're doing today than how the processes were done in the past.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, the problem, you know, kind of piggybacking on what you said, Tom, is when you ask somebody kind of what are you willing to pay, you get answers all over the board. It doesn't work, right? You know, or what would you like to pay? Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to pay. I'd like to pay nothing, right? Those types of questions just, you know, research has shown again and again, don't do a good job of actually pegging the amount of dollars somebody's willing to pay for some type of public benefit. And this approach here does a much better job of doing that. So that's kind of why we're tackling it this way. If you go down a little bit, so question 7 has dollar amounts attached to properties that are behind the gates. Question 8 is the exact same question, only this is the question that if you're a property outside the gate, you're going to get. So only question 7 only goes to those behind the gates. Question 8 goes to properties outside the gates. And you can see it's the same basic question, only the dollar amounts are different. This is my doing. I was sort of looking at some of the scenarios that have been discussed for what would a security measure look like and recognizing that the properties outside the gates are paying less per Measure J than the ones behind the gates. And so I'd sort of work them down. And you can see that basically they're about $100 less per year than the properties behind the gates. You know, we would want to make sure and think hard about those to make sure that, again, we're talking about different rates per parcel, et cetera, et cetera. But that's how this is structured here. They're starting lower and then they go lower. But otherwise, it's the same exercise of trying to figure out if at what level here, A, B, C, somebody's willing to come in and vote yes, if at all. Okay, moving on. So after this, we get into what I call the services and improvements section, which is question 9. And the idea here is twofold. Number one, we are going to now start to educate this respondent more about what this measure could accomplish. We've only had that 75-word ballot statement to describe the measure to this point. And as you know, about half those words are devoted to other things. They're not really describing what the measure would do. And so here we get to unpack this measure into a variety of things you could spend the money on. And in that way, the respondent's getting a better idea about what's being proposed. The other thing it allows us to do is to understand for each of these items, how do voters feel about it, right? Do they favor spending some of the money on this particular item or not, right? And it'll tell us what voters view as priorities for this potential measure, and also if there's anything in this list that they really don't think should be part of this measure and they don't support. So as you can read down this list, you've got item A about continue providing security gate officers 24 hours per day year round. to control community access, prevent trespassing. B is the private security patrols. C is the sheriff's deputies with full law enforcement powers. One of the things that kind of came out very clearly from a number of the community groups that we held a few weeks back was, you know, an interest in having some actual teeth in the security, right? That they wanted the, you know, full law enforcement powers. And so without getting into the details about how, you know, private security patrols don't have the same enforcement powers as law enforcement, one way to sort of beef this up in the community is to have additional patrols by sheriff's deputies. And so there seemed to be some interest, quite a bit of interest in that. And that's one of the, it's one of the, why we're going to be interested to see how item C tests in the poll. And then if you go down from there, you know, it's a little more about the things that are some of the ways in which having more security can be focused. So better enforcing speed limits and safe driving, reducing vandalism, graffiti, property damage, reducing trespassing by non-residents. Again, here, this is to get an understanding of where residents might see a need and, you know, better security to sort of focus their attention in the future should the measure pass. Not meant to be, you know, completely exhaustive of all the things, but it's kind of hitting on the big items. So after that section, we get into what we call the argument section of the survey. And, you know, the reality is if this board chooses to place a measure on an upcoming ballot, there is going to be an election cycle, right? And during that election cycle, you're going to have some folks who are advocates of this measure, right? Who believe it's something that we is needed. And they will go out and they'll talk to their neighbors and friends and they'll campaign on behalf of this measure to try and persuade voters to support it. You might also have people in the community who think it's a bad idea. We shouldn't be doing this. And they will convey and talk to their neighbors and friends and share arguments as to why they should vote no. For this to be a reliable gauge of the feasibility of a potential measure, we need to be able to simulate that discussion and debate in the space of this poll so that we know not only where are your voters today, which was that initial ballot test, but where are they once they are exposed to the types of arguments and debate and discussion that they're going to get exposed to during the election cycle. So we do that by testing both positive and negative arguments. Question 10 is where we introduce positive arguments. These are meant to be arguments on behalf of this measure designed to persuade someone to vote yes. And so you can see here as you move down the list, we say supporters of the measure say blank and you insert a variety of positive arguments here. All the A is all the money stays local, right? Can't be used for, can't be taken away by the state or used for other purposes. That's an important one. When people vote in favor of these types of tax measures, they want to know that the money's staying local, that it's not going to get sucked away by the state government or county government or what have you. So then you go down item B, the concept of having accountability provisions built into a proposal like this. There will be some conservative voters who, although they may want security, more security, they're of the opinion that, you know, government is wasteful and you can't trust government. And so, you know, they're going to want to see that, hey, if I vote yes on this, the money is going to be spent the way it's supposed to be spent. And so things like annual reports to the community or independent audits of citizen oversight are things that give them the comfort to vote yes if they're sort of mistrustful of government in general. C, and you know, this is optional and we can talk about it, but my general recommendation is, you know, because you do have a conservative community, right? And undoubtedly there's going to be some folks who would find item B sort of an attractive feature. Like, yeah, if we're going to have this, I want to make sure that, you know, we have a clear sort of system of accountability. You know, it's a good idea to have that built in, but it is optional. C1 and C2, understand the C1, C2 part, that's called a split sample. Half the people we speak with are going to get C1. Half the people we're going to speak with are going to get C2. They're kind of two versions of the same argument, right? That, you know, C1, that many of the reasons people move out to Rancho Murrieta is to be in a safe gated community with private security. you know, we need to support this measure to keep our community safe. C2 is, you know, the fact that, again, it's related to the fact that Murrieta, Rancho Murrieta is, you know, unlike a lot of other communities in that you do have your own private security, and this measure is needed to keep, you know, keep the investments up in that. So we're just split sampling because I wouldn't want to ask this, both of these arguments to the same people because they sound a little similar. And then item D hits on the fact that kind of puts, you know, things into perspective, that, you know, California is, you know, they put 76,000 prisoners on an eligibility list for early parole early this year, which means, you know, you're getting a lot more criminals released all over the state, including your area. And so kind of hits on that as a reason for why, you know, now's an important time to make sure our security is where it needs to be. Keep on rolling down. E gets on the idea that you've got somebody to respond quickly day or night to emergencies. And if you cut back on security, that's not necessarily going to be the case. F links the fact that you have a safe and secure community to local property values, right? So if you want to keep Rancho Murrieta a special place to live, we need to be investing in our safety and security. And then G, this is important because there's kind of this idea oftentimes when you have revenue measures that if I vote no, things are just going to stay the same the way they are now, right? The reality is the district's operating at a deficit when it comes to security, and you can't, you know, a vote no on this doesn't just maintain the status quo. It's going to involve cuts and changes potentially, right? So that's what G is about. You want to always be careful when you're talking about revenue measures. The last thing you want to do is have a bunch of arguments out there that sound like Armageddon is coming if you vote no, right? If you don't support this, you know, we're going to have murderers and rapists walking our streets and or whatever you want to say about it. The thing is, voters hate to be threatened, right? It's just a really bad idea to put arguments out there that sound like doomsday arguments. That said, you do sometimes need to have an argument like item G just so they're aware, right? That hey, if this doesn't pass, you know, it's going to force cuts with respect to security and support officers and patrols. So any questions, comments, concerns about items A through G at this point?
Marty, anything?
I understand it's reasonable to ask for an opinion on independent audits and citizen oversight, but I'm not sure how we would accomplish that. Maybe we just leave it in and ask and see what it's important.
Yeah, it again, these are things that aren't required, but I will tell you in just about every tax measure we do, whether it be for a city, a school district, a special district, we build them in. You know, like I said, there's a lot, particularly if you're in a conservative community, you know, there are some voters out there who that will be the hang up issue for them, right? That they want more security, but they also want some sort of citizen oversight committee built into this. Understand that the citizens oversight committee does not take the role of the board. Right. Their job is really just to review and say, you know, the measure said we're going to spend it on this, this and that. And lo and behold, let's look at the financials. Yes. You know, all the money was spent on this, this and that. It's really confirming the funds are being dispersed in a way that's consistent with the measure itself.
OK.
They aren't there to sort of say, board, we want you to change how you're spending it, as long as you're spending it in ways that are consistent with the measure, that, you know, so they're not assuming the responsibilities of the board. Okay. So after the positive arguments are tested there, take a look at Q11. This is what we call the interim ballot test. Exact same language as that initial ballot test, but understand that this point in the poll, voters have heard more about this proposal, right? We talked in detail about the tax rates that could be associated with the measure. We talked in more detail about the services that could be funded, and we've conveyed positive arguments. So we circle back in question 11 and get another read on where they land on this proposal. And in particular, we're looking for movement, right? I mean, have we gone up, down, or stayed the same with each voter? After that initial ballot, after the interim ballot test, we get to what we call the negatives, if you want to pan down. So just like we tested positive arguments, we are also going to test negative arguments, right? These are arguments that we would expect to hear from an opponent of this measure, because again, if the goal was to have a reasonable understanding of and a realistic understanding of, you know, how much support there is in the community for this proposal, we need to sort of simulate both sides of the discussion. So item A talks about how property owners are already paying the district a lot of money for water, sewer, and security, that you've got plenty of money, you just need to do a better job managing it. I'm sure you've probably heard that argument before. That's a pretty typical one of folks who, you know, oppose a tax measure, the idea that you've already got enough money, you just need to do a better job managing it. So we test that. Item B is kind of this idea that now is not a good time to be raising taxes, particularly on the heels of the pandemic. Item C, tax will last forever. There's no expiration date, right, built into this. Item D gets at the CPI increase, that it automatically increases 3% every year. And then item E is the argument that we've heard a few folks saying you should just outsource security to a private company, you'd get more for your money. This item E is something that we've had a few discussions about. I put it in here as a negative argument, potentially, that you could hear if you move forward with this proposal, right? If it comes up, you could see someone going, you know, whether it's true or not, this idea that we should just outsource and we get more for our money. The reality is, when I've looked at this issue with other agencies, when it comes to sort of outsourcing police functions, for example, oftentimes what you find is this is all about trade-offs, right? Could you lower the amount of dollars you spend? Yes, but what are you giving up? Oftentimes you're not getting the same level of service for less money. You're getting lower levels of service for the money. You lose control of the hiring and firing process. You give up a lot, right? So I would hesitate to ask this question in a sort of neutral way unless we know what the specifics of that are, right? You know, exactly, if you're going to outsource, how does that compare in terms of service levels? How does that compare in terms of costs? And so I didn't build it into some separate question, but I anticipate it could be used as a negative, regardless of how true it is. And so I had built it in as item E. So let me stop here and see if there's any reactions to this.
Yeah, this is John. My reaction, I don't know even know if it's a question. I think it is something that no matter what happens with the ballot measure itself, that I think it's important that we understand. And I think we need to ask it someplace. And Tim, if you're comfortable that this is the right place to ask it, then I definitely am in favor of asking the question.
Yeah, I would say one thing about E. E is purposely phrased as an argument against the measure, right? Hey, you know, we should outsource security. We get more for our money. And it kind of, you know, the implication being, and we don't need this proposal, right? It's a little bit of a separate question to ask somebody, hey, do you think we should have, should we outsource? Or should we, you know, keep district staff in terms of security? That question, I think you have to be careful, because if you just, you know, it's very easy to leave the impression that outsourcing is somehow going to be the silver bullet, right? It you get all these services for less money, but the reality is that's probably not the case, right? And if we're going to ask the question sort of specifically about which would they prefer, I think we have to have solid facts on both sides, right? Meaning we need to have some understanding of exactly, could you actually get better service for less money, right? And what would that look like? What do you give up, right? So that we're giving people a fair choice that reflects the actual circumstances, as opposed to giving them something that sounds like they get their cake and eat it too, right?
Marty, what do you think?
I think it's a valid question, although it's hard to quantify, like I said, you said, but seems like a valid question.
Yeah, and I'll just back up a second. The only thing I think that's really good is that at the end of this, and maybe it's just the way I interpret it, and maybe it's not what we get, but I think it lends itself to telling us that, you know, private security is a consideration, or on the other hand, no way, no how, whether we increase the money or we don't, private security is not an option. That's what I'm trying to learn. And, you know, I think it will help us. So that's why I guess I'm in favor of leaving it where it is.
Yeah. So understand, though, and I just want to make sure we're clear. You could get a strong reaction to item E, right? You could have 60% of people say it's a convincing reason to vote no on the measure, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that 60% of people favor going to private security, right? We would need to ask that question differently, right? And we could, if we wanted to, build that very direct question in later in the poll, like after the final ballot test here, and simply ask. But if we're going to do it, I think it's important that we paint a realistic picture of the choice, right? If, you know, would you favor keeping our, you know, security staff, which are, you know, hired and managed by, you know, a public agency, and, you know, we get to set the standards for their performance, or, you know, we can outsource to private security. We may actually be able to do so a bit more cost effectively, but we lose control of the hiring, firing process, and, you know, whatever else sort of comes with that, right? I've also seen cases where you go, well, realistically, no, because, you know, you still have unfunded liabilities you've got to cover for, you know, past and current employees and this and that. And in the end, it just doesn't pencil out as being cheaper, right? So I think that's the thing that we would have to make sure we're doing if we ask that question, I think, is to get a realistic, fair description of what the choice really is.
Marty, I think, you know, what one of the thoughts I had going forward after we've gone through this whole thing is that we recommend we take this to the board at our next meeting as a discussion item. And, you know, I don't feel comfortable, like in this particular case, making that choice on our own. But if we were to take this whole thing to the board so we could have an open discussion on our next meeting, we could then conceivably bring it back here again, refine it, and then take it back to the board, you know, for final consideration. But I kind of think we need more than you and I to really get through this, to really understand collectively as a board how we feel about this.
I would agree that it needs some discussion with the board, but I think they, just like me, the other board members need information on how we got these fees, how many sheriffs we're going to provide. Are we going to do equal fees to everybody? Is this 3% CPI correct? What if we have more services required? What we're going to do if we like open this second gate? What are we going to do? So, I think those things need to be given to the board for discussion, so they really know what we're proposing.
Right. So that's where I was proposing maybe that we take it back to the next board meeting to do exactly what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure, depending on how much is on that agenda, maybe we're having like a special board meeting or like a workshop just on this specific issue. I don't know whether we have to or we should, but it seems like there might be, answering all those questions that you highlighted, is going to take more time than maybe a 15-minute segment in an upcoming board meeting.
Probably.
Yeah. But at this point, Tim, go through the rest of it so that
sure. And we're near the end here. So if you scan down after the negatives, we have the final ballot test. Same exact language, only now it's on the heels of them being exposed to negative arguments about the proposal. And so as you kind of think back over all the questions we've asked in the survey, we have reads on a voter's opinion and willingness to support this proposal at three different points, right? Initial ballot test with just the information they have out there in the world today, right? An interim test, once they've heard more about the range of tax rates that may be applied, the service that can be funded in positive arguments, and the final ballot test where they've also been exposed to negatives. This gives us a good understanding of kind of where your voters today, as well as where might they be at the end of an election cycle once they've been sort of informed about and exposed to a lot of the particulars related to the measure, as well as arguments pro and con. And so that's why we set it up this way. The, you know, question 13 seems a little repetitive. We're asking it, you know, a third time, but that's the logic, right? We're looking for movement. I have seen measures where you really don't see hardly any movement between, say, the interim ballot test and the final ballot test, that the negatives don't really have much of an impact. I have seen them drop support as much as 16 points for a proposal. So it's really important that to get a realistic read that we test both the positives and the negatives. And then after the final ballot test, we just have a few follow-up questions here. If you go down. Keep scrolling here. So question 14. So question, the ballot tests as they were set up were all set up with the idea that we're going to be enhancing the security services in a few ways, right? And the dollar amounts lined up with enhancements. My understanding is right now that based on the services you're currently providing, right, you're still operating at a deficit for security of about $171 per year for residential properties behind the gates. And so question 14 is a follow-up question for anybody who's sort of opposed to this measure at the final ballot test or unsure. We simply ask, okay, what if it were set at a lower amount, $171 per year? This is the amount needed to continue providing current levels of security in the community and avoid having to make deep cut security patrols, right? So this, once again, sort of gets out the idea that a no vote doesn't mean, you know, we just stay where we're at, right? That we need funds to be able to stay where we're at. Otherwise, we're going to have to make cuts, right? So that's what 14 is about. And then after that, we just have a few follow-up questions. We ask in 15 to tell us how safe they feel Rancho Murrieta is as a place to live. Keep going. For those who have lived in the community at least 5 years, we ask them, would they say it's safe for today, about the same or less safe when compared to 5 years ago, right? So is there some sort of trend people are seeing in terms of safety? 17 is, I was asking what the public safety issue or security problem that you'd most like to see addressed in the community. So what is it? Is it, you know, vandalism? Is it speeding vehicles? Is it, I'm worried about burglary? What is it, right? That seems to be the safety issue of concern to that particular voter. Here again, open-ended, they get to tell us in their own words. And then that's it in terms of the questions we ask. Everything in green here that says post-interview and sample items, This is information that we will have based on the voter file. We don't have to ask it. We already know it going in, but I want to show it so you have an understanding of all the information we have. So gender, party, affiliation, the age that is on the voter file. And then if you scroll down,
okay, I don't have any questions or hands up, John.
Okay, are did we scroll down? Are we at the end?
Yeah, can we scroll down a little bit? There's a few more here.
Yeah, keep going then, Amelia. Thanks.
And then basically registration date, we'll know when someone registered. Household party type, S5. This isn't something that's actually on the county voter file. It's something that we are, through one of our sample providers, are able to enhance. It basically looks at the household profile. This variable tends to be the best predictor of how people tend to vote on revenue measures. If you are a single Democrat, for example, that you tend to be obviously left-leaning and a bit in general tax-friendly. If you live with another Democrat, that tends to enhance your leaning. And so partisans with somebody of the same partisanship tend to be super partisan. So the most liberal individuals tend to be in dual Democratic households. The most conservative individuals tend to be in dual Republican households, right? And the people who live in mixed households, they fight a lot. So we look at this household party type when we're pulling our sample to make sure we are matching what your community looks like. It also becomes a very useful variable by which to analyze how support varies across subgroups. And then as you go down, we got, you know, the I think it's zip code, whether or not they're a homeowner. That's another enhanced field we have. And then likely June 2022 voter and likely November 2022 voter. This is based on the individual's voting history, right? You will have voters who, although they're registered to vote, don't often, you know, won't cast ballots, right? They've been registered for 6 years and they've yet to cast a ballot. Those are the kind of voters who we go, probably not actually going to participate in the election of interest, right? We want to see that somebody is likely, based on their registration date and past voting behavior, to actually cast a ballot in the election that we're considering. That means they're a likely voter. And we want to make sure that, you know, those are the kind of people that we're focusing on in the survey. So that is the end of the questionnaire. Happy to answer any questions that may come from the committee members or,
Go ahead, Marty.
You're doing this by phone. How many people are you calling?
So we're shooting to get 400 completed interviews. You are a small community, but you are also, because you're a small community and have a lot of, I think, community identity, I'm hopeful we can hit that mark. Obviously, not everybody is going to participate that we reach out to, right? And so, but if we happen to do well with participation, we shoot over 400, that's great too. So we're not going to cap it at 400, but 400 is kind of the number that we want to make sure we hit.
Great, thanks.
And Tim, is there a ratio of mail outs to physical callers that you're going to make telephone calls?
Yeah, so we use four different methods of recruiting, but we tend to sequence them. So we do have mailed letters that can invite a voter to take the survey, right? We tend to focus those on voters for whom we don't have good contact information in other ways, right? There are some voters who maybe on the voter file, all we have is their physical address, right? We don't have a phone number. We don't have an email address, for example. We can enhance some of that for some voters, but not all voters. And then we can reach out by email. We can reach out with text messages, and we reach out by telephone calls. We tend to kind of do it in that order because you're going from less intrusive to more intrusive, right? Rather than starting with phone calls why not give them a chance to respond to a letter or an email or text message before you're ringing their phone?
Is it a good idea, a bad idea? We should never do it. Should we generate, not that we're not going to have a lot anyway, but should we generate more community awareness by saying, hey, there is a survey, you may be chosen, be sure you do it? Or is it better if we say absolutely nothing?
I think in this case, given that you're a really small community, and you know, I kind of describe communities like yours, you're a bit of a fishbowl, right? Everybody knows what's going on in the fishbowl. And so I would say, you know, you have your site, or if you have your normal communication methods to the community, you should say, hey, by the way, you know, the district's going to be doing a survey. So if you get called, you know, it's legit and please respond and share your opinions. Something like that is good.
Okay.
Right. We don't want to say too much again about what it's about, or, you know, because that can create that selection bias I spoke about earlier.
Right. Right. Okay. Any other questions?
I don't have any hands raised or any chats. I'll get something ready for the website, Tim, or if you have like a sample that you could share with me, I will just put that up verbatim.
Okay.
But when I get something up and ready to go, I'll send it over to you so that you could, and then you can okay it for me. Okay.
Sounds great.
Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think this is terrific.
Great.
I have a vision here that no matter what we do, we will now answer a lot of questions that we've been asking in different ways for years, that maybe we will understand a little bit more about security in general, the perception, what people want, what they don't want, what they're willing to spend. So whether this goes all the way to a ballot or not, I think this is really going to be terrific information.
Great.
Marty, anything?
Well, thank you.
Anything further on this item? Anybody? No?
No.
No.
Okay, great. Okay. Thanks again, Tim.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Tim.
One more item, Paula, late fees, delinquencies, and water shutoff. I don't suspect there's anything we're going to have to recommend to the board on this, right?
No. We just wanted to let the public know that the water shutoff moratorium was set to expire September 30th, and Governor Newsom extended it to December 31st, 2021. So it's just a reminder that we want all of the residents who still have outstanding bills to contact us, get those payment arrangements going. If they need assistance with payments, we would love to get them on a payment plan. And we will be postponing our water shutoffs until after the beginning of the new year.
Okay.
And Paula, we are also posting any sort of assistance programs that are out there for renters and eventually possibly homeowners for falling behind just due to the COVID pandemic issues, correct? Those sites are on our website, correct?
Yes, this is correct. Our website does have a link. It's on our banner when you open up the RMCSD webpage. And if you click on the link, it's shra.org. And there's resources for both renters and homeowners regarding delinquent payments.
Okay. Anything further on that item? Amelia, nothing?
No hands raised, no chats.
Okay. Director and staff comments. Staff first, anybody?
I just want to remind everybody who's on the line, is just us and Gail and Richard, but we're district offices are closed tomorrow. It's a full day of training. And other than that, thank you everyone for all your work.
The only thing we need to, I guess, resolve, and I'll leave this to Tom and Paula to decide, depending on how much time you think we're going to need on this item, on the questionnaire at the next meeting to figure out what the best way to do this is? Do we handle it as part of the meeting based on all the other stuff we have to do? Or do we spin it off and have either a workshop type thing or a special meeting, just so we don't wind up, you know, being at this till 10 o'clock at night?
You're talking about a board meeting, right?
Yeah. Okay. So we'll kind of leave that to you. That's my opinion anyway. Marty, have you got anything?
Oh, I don't have anything. I agree with your idea about the next board meeting.
Okay. Anybody else? Anything further? Okay, then we'll move to item 7 and adjourn. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Everyone.
Thank you. Have a great day.